Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm here with Alex Yoncher, the CEO of Passport. Really glad for you to join us, Alex.
Thanks, Rick. Glad to be here.
Let's start at the beginning. I mean, cross-border shipping, succeeding in countries that aren't your native country, whether it's across borders or, you know, you actually go and set up shop in another country, I think it's something a lot of brands are familiar with. So I would love to like go back to the beginning. I'm really a fan of sort of origin stories, and like, tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you found Passport, and like, why does it exist?
Yeah, totally. So before I founded Passport, I actually had another company called Lynx, which was in the international cross-border e-commerce space. It was a really interesting company, actually. People would go to a website, let's say Allbirds or Amazon, and they would take a link, get it, play words, links. So they would take a link to a product that they wanted to buy. They would drop it into our universal shopping cart. They would pay us for it. They would pay for the shipping, for the duties and taxes, our fees, and the product costs, of course. We would get that money. And then we would go on the website of Allbirds, Amazon, so forth, and we would put in our Delaware address. So we had a physical warehouse in Delaware where we receive all of these packages. Delaware is a tax-free state, so we would save everybody's state tax. And I ran ops for that company. So I was a co-founder and I ran operations. I was the COO. And it was my job to figure out how to ship items, big or small, cheaper, expensive, all over the world. And in running that company, I realized that international is so much more than just the physical logistics. You also have to know what the regulatory compliance is for these types of products. So every country has their own FDA. And, you know, in Canada, they have this thing called Health Canada, for example. And you have to be in compliance with every country's laws in relation to what you're bringing in for the most part. And so that's one big thing. Then every country has their own, you know, tax and duty regime. So some countries have a federal tax system, you know, and then some countries like Canada, they actually have both a federal tax, a GST, and then they have provincial state tax, PST. So you have to know how much to collect from the customer, and then you're going to be on the line when you go and clear customs and ship it to the consumer. Don't get me started on returns. That's a whole other piece of a problem to solve, you know, for a cross border. But this was my life for a few years running that operation in the warehouse. And I realized, you know, as I was putting together this patchwork of solutions, you know, we might be using one of the like branded carriers for the actual physical logistics, but then we'd be using a different solution for calculating duties and taxes, and then another solution for returns, and then another solution for some of the localization of baking in the VAT and the duty into the price of the good. And the systems never spoke to each other. There was always this question of, wait a second, why does my invoice show that I owe $2.50 for VAT, but when my software told me to charge my customer, I charged them only 50 cents? What's the disconnect? Everybody wants to say that they're wrong, and you're constantly fighting fires trying to figure out what the disconnect is. So my vision or my insight at the time was that this would work really well as an integrated solution, you know, under one roof. The systems speak to each other, and it's turnkey for the buyer so that they can have a truly international experience, turnkey, day one, end to end, and not have to kind of go find different things, plug them together, make sure that they all work, but something that really works out of the box seamlessly.
Yeah, I mean, that's exciting. I mean, because you're taking something which you created as a service for buyers, and you're almost like trying to fix those problems at the source, which is like at the point the brand goes on and offers their products to begin with.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. I used to joke that I'm going to put my previous company out of business, and really my previous company shouldn't even exist in the first place. Right. It still exists, actually. So, you know, clearly there's not enough solutions out there at the source to fix all of the, you know, corner cases of international. But surely, you know, that's the idea, is that like you really want every brand to be able to service customers all over the world, you know, help brands reach the global potential. That's actually our vision statement at Passport.
Yeah, well, I guess every brand who's not yet on your platform is still in need of a freight forwarder and maybe your old website.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Talk to me about Passport. Who's your ideal customer for this? Because there's obviously a big range of merchants and retailers, and not everything is a fit for cross-border or global commerce.
Yeah, you know, I think we're probably going to talk about this at some point later as well, but I would say every brand is global day one, whether or not they know it. And what I mean by that is every brand has a website. Every website is accessible to anybody around the world. And frankly speaking, all of the top of funnel work that a brand does, whether it's with influencers or Google or Instagram, all of those channels, they're all global. Right. So like 80% of the daily active users for Instagram are outside of the US. If you go on, you know, Kim Kardashian's, really anything, TikTok, her followers, and you were to kind of drill down where her followers are, I would be surprised if US makes up more than 20%. So if you're really anything that you're doing, you're always going to have some spray to other countries. So you're really, by definition, global. Anything that's SEO is searchable, you know, you have a unique product. Well, somebody in Canada or Brazil is going to find it and they're going to click and be on your website. It's a different story, Rick, if you can actually transact with that customer and they can add it to cart and they could, you know, ship it to their home. That's a different story. But top of funnel and marketing wise and getting your name out there, you're already global. The second that you get started and you buy that GoDaddy, you know, URL, you're already global.
Right.
So the reason I'm mentioning that is because we aim to serve brands really from the very beginning to them scaling. And that's how we've evolved. Nuances to that point. So no, we can't work with a really small brand that self-fulfills and ships only one package a day. We can't do that. However, if that really small brand works with one of the 3PLs that we work with, I don't know if you know this, but we work with about, I think, like 150 3PLs at this point. You know, some are focused on direct-to-consumer, some are a little bit more B2B, but we work some of the biggest direct-to-consumer focused ones. And some of them, like a Shipmunk and a ShipBob, they work with really small brands.
Right.
They work with really big brands as well, but they work with a lot of really small brands. And we're the international partner, not just for brands, but for 3PLs as well. So we'll onboard a small brand that might ship just one thing a month, and they'll still be a customer because they work with a 3PL that we work with.
Right.
Okay. So we work with really small ones, but we work with huge ones as well. So we work with Hexclad, you know, enormous, sometimes billion-dollar brands. We work with iHerb, you know, that's a multi-billion-dollar brand. And for them, it's just a different set of solutions and different things that you know, what success looks like for those types of brands. But really, we try to work with brands that are big and small and fulfill that, you know, internationally. That's more of our niche. It's not so much the type of brand that we work with, but we really try to focus on international for brands.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. When people come to you, how do they describe their own problem that they're trying to solve?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I think this kind of goes back to our solution set. I'll bucket what we do for brands into three categories. Okay. One is on international compliance and all the headaches that go with that. And I mean compliance as in, like, does it need, you know, Health Canada approval or, you know, the local FDA approval? Does it need markings on it? You know, electrical markings, because it's a piece of electronics, you know, those kind of questions, but also financial ones, fiscal ones. I don't know if you know this, but the UK has a law that even if a merchant, it's called distance selling, even if a merchant sells $1 into UK, they have to register with HMRC, that's their IRS, and pay VAT on that $1. Okay. And it's the merchant's responsibility to register and pay that VAT. So big headache for a lot of merchants to do that. So that's sometimes the headache that brands come to us with, and they say, you know, do I like what documentation do I need in order to sell this? Can you help me with that? And then I don't want to register for VAT in UK, EU, Australia, Norway, Singapore.
Can you do that for me?
Can you do that for me? And the answer is absolutely, we can. We have some great solutions for it, where we basically stand in the place of the merchant in the eyes of that local government. And we collect VAT and any other, you know, duties and fees and all that on behalf of that merchant. And then it's our responsibility to go and file and register on our VAT number. So these brands are riding on our, you know, registration rails and doing that. That's one bucket. The other bucket is on internationalization. So this is like, you know, crawl, walk, run. I would say that this is a little bit of the walk, maybe leading into a little bit of the running, where you've gone global, like you can ship to any country in the world, but everything is still in US dollars. And your treatment of duties and taxes is suboptimal, to say the least. You're doing things that confuse somebody in the UK. Why do you have VAT broken out? I've never seen that before. You know, people in the UK, they're not used to seeing VAT broken out as a separate line item. It's baked into the price of the good, right? So that's the other bucket. We come in and we localize the website. Local currencies, local treatment of prices, all of those types of things. Okay. So that, you know, brands will come to us and say, you know, I'm so successful internationally. Domestically, my conversion rate is X, but I'm looking at my Canada business, and actually I have a Canadian influencer. I have Alanis Morissette, you know, and she's bringing us so much business into the US. But for Canada, I'm getting all these hits, but my conversion rate is in the garbage. It's horrible. Like, I don't know what to do. And, you know, that's where we come in and we say, it's because they're not used to this experience. It confuses them. It throws them off. It makes them feel like something is off. Let's localize it for a traditional Canadian experience, you know, with poutine, as you know, in the pictures, and you know, the maple leaf rather than hamburger and fries, right? So localization is really critical. And then the third bucket is another really big part of cross-border, is just the reality of a shipment is it's going farther. So shipping it across the pond to UK or Europe or Asia, it's just a different beast of a service than shipping it locally here in the US. You're crossing borders, you're shipping it over an ocean, you're adding transit time days. You know, if you did everything right, you still need to cross an ocean, you know, to get to UK. And that's just going to add some time and some complexity, and things can, you know, COVID, you know, like things can, you know, go wrong really quickly. So you need a partner that really knows what they're doing and has control of the logistics chain. So that's another thing that we bring to the table, is we're vertically integrated with our own international parcel solution. We have three warehouses that we manage, and we're in control of every leg of the journey that we have. And we're able to be nimble. We're able to be flexible when that's required. Sometimes we have clients that say they do subscription, and transit time doesn't really matter for them, but cost does. So they'll tell us, you know, don't give me the 5-day service. Give me the 15-day service. Give me your slowest service that you possibly have, but give me your lowest price. Right. You know, you can't do that if you're, you know, one of the branded carriers. They have one service. They're such an enormous organization. They can't construct something special for this type of thing. It's like a 7-day service, and it's a 7-day service for everybody, and they can't make it slower and cheaper. But we can. We can work with clients and coming up with bespoke solutions for them that solve for one thing or the other. Sometimes customers want us to solve for speed. Great. We have faster services that are going to be a little bit more expensive. So, you know, that's another thing that customers come to us with the bigger ones. You know, the 8-9-figure brands, they come to us with custom problems. You know, oh, you know, can we ship everything from the East Coast? Because most of our business is on the East Coast of Canada, and it's in Europe. It's okay if you charge me more for Australia, you know? So, you know, things like that, we come up with bespoke solutions, bespoke pricing for bigger accounts. And they really love that about working with Passport.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that all makes sense. And I think it's sort of removing friction from the seller who's trying to no, increase their international sales. They don't have to register with the UK, be slapped with fines or be chased down. Like, there's so much hassle in your country, much less in all these countries you don't know anything about. And then on the other side, which I think is a little bit forgotten part of the time, because you have, you know, for a brand, it's like, you don't know what you don't know. You didn't grow up in these other cultures. You didn't grow up in these other markets. You don't understand how they present things to people that might seem like second nature. And so it's almost like you're a cheat code for these merchants to sort of like get culturally smart in, you know, I don't know, hundreds of different markets very quickly.
Yep. Exactly right. Exactly right.
And how, just generally, obviously, you have your rate card, it's negotiated with every client, but like, how do you generally charge your services?
Yeah, we have two components. One is we're essentially a logistics company, and we have a rate card. Well, it looks similar to the way your FedEx, DHL, UPS rate cards are going to look like on a matrix. Columns are countries, rows are weight breaks. And that's that part of our solution. We call that passport shipping. And then we have an internationalization solution that comes with everything else that I'm talking about here. So like the localization work that we do for brands, the compliance aspects, the seller of record service that I was describing, where brands ride on our rails, on our registration rails, so they don't need to register in UK and so forth. All of that we charge as a percentage of the order value.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay, so that makes sense. I mean, just generally know if a brand approaches you, that's what they sort of expect to see, when they sort of get to that point. Clearly there's, some stuff that I'm sure in like, I don't know, either 2 days or 2 years or 2 minutes will date this podcast in terms of 2025. And tariffs volatility, there's trade barriers which might appear one day and go the next day. Like, I guess, how is Passport thinking about how it helps brands in this, in volatile environments generally, but also in this one in particular?
Yeah. Let's start with this one in particular. It's a unique one. I would generalize away from the specific moment that the U.S. is going into a protectionist era under the Trump administration. Irrespective of the deal that's going to come together between U.S. and China and U.S. and other countries, this is an administration that's looking at tariffs for revenue generation, and they're philosophically aligned with tariffs. So the question is, to what extent, what are going to be the exceptions, but there certainly will be a much higher tariff regime than we've had in the past. And then it's anybody's guess on what's going to happen after this, administration. So the way we're helping with that is really twofold. There's really two things you can do. Mm-hmm. One is a meta point. One big meta point is to start diversifying your downstream market away from the United States. If you are a brand, chances are you're going to be manufacturing abroad. In some categories, it's, almost virtually certain you're going to be manufacturing abroad, like homeware products, toys, all of that is made outside the United States. And it's going to take many years, if ever, that it reshores to the United States. So if you bring things in, the before and after is you're just going to have to pay this higher amount as this like tax to the government, okay? Tariffs, right? And it could be 10%, it could be 30%, whatever, or 145%, whatever it is, it's going to be something. Have everything that you're selling to the United States just be more expensive. So you're a little bit less competitive, not necessarily against your competitors who are in the same boat, but just like against just general consumer spending interest where they want to put their dollar. right? Mm-hmm. So what can you do? Well, you can diversify to other countries that have less of a tax on imports and less of a tax on this sort of economic activity. And, you know, to a certain extent, a lot of non-American brands are going to be much more successful or just much left much more intact after this whole moment ends. Because like if you're a Canadian brand, your exposure to the U.S. might be like only 30% or 40%, you know, the rest being to Canada and rest of world. So if your sales to the U.S. drop by 10%, that's a percentage of a percentage, you know, you're going to go from your total decrease is going to go by 4% if you're exposed by 40% to the U.S. But American brands are exposed 90%, you know, unfortunately, you know, something right. to that order of magnitude. So what they want to do is they want to start diversifying away from the United States. At the very least, you know, make international 25% of your business, you know, that even that will help, right? So for that, you know, there's a couple of ways of making that happen. One way is you can domicile inventory locally in Canada, in UK, Australia, and so forth, in your major markets, and avoid the US tariff regime. So ship product from China mm-hmm. or wherever your manufacturer directly into Canada and start fulfilling locally from Canada. And that has a lot of benefits. You know, your local shipping is cheaper. You're avoiding the, you know, you're avoiding paying Canadian duties on the retail costs. You're going to be paying them on the inbound freight, you know, cost of goods sold. So a lot of, you know, returns become easier. So there's a lot of benefits mm-hmm. to doing local in-country enablement or fulfillment if you can make it work. We have a turnkey solution for it. We do that for some major brands like Hexclad and Ridge and some other really big ones. So that's a big part. The other way that we can help is some brands just, they can't execute on a local fulfillment model for whatever reason. You know, some brands, you know, we work some brands that are really big and they have a lot of sales, but they have a ton of SKUs. So they have literally tens of thousands of yeah. SKUs, and that's kind of hard to do internationally in multiple nodes. Right. So you're basically relegated to servicing your international market from the United States. So then what can you do? Well, there's a do you drawback solution that we offer. So when you ship something internationally, you get to draw back the duties that you paid when you imported the goods. So the government, you know, this is like one gimme that the government yeah. does is they let you draw back.
Because it's not, you imported it under the assumption that you were going to sell it to a U.S. buyer. You ended up not selling it to a U.S. buyer. That's called duty drawback.
Exactly. Exactly. So those are the two, you know, those are the two specific tactics around this, you know, this trade war protectionist tariff crisis that we're in right now. Right. And then largely everything else that we're doing is already aligned with helping brands. We've been saying to brands, diversify away from the U.S., you know, since I started the company about 8 years ago, you know, it doesn't hurt.
But now weren't listening to you before. Now they have a reason to heed your advice.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
That's insane. Obviously in different categories of products like fashion versus CPG versus, lithium, you know, electronics that I might have lithium ion batteries versus different, you know, big and bulky things. Do brands in different categories need to prepare differently for, I guess, tariffs and internationalization generally?
Yeah, they do. I mean, let's take a step back. Before this whole hubbaloo with Trump and tariffs started, there were already tariffs. So tariffs are nothing new. Even for the United States, they're nothing new. This idea that we were completely free trade and that we didn't have any tariffs on anything that came into the United States, it's just not true. In fact, we had very high tariffs. For Chinese-made goods, the tariffs range, just depending on the commodity, somewhere between 10 and 39%. I think the highest one was 39%, okay? And on some pretty popular categories, you know, so nothing like, you know, protectionist things on like national security items. Like we had 39% tariffs on like belts, you know, and fashion items. So tariffs already existed, and for the most part, the tariffs were already double digit, you know, not like in the 30s or 40s, but like in the low 10s, right. You know? Right. So tariffs already existed, and tariffs exist on a product by product basis. There are some commodities that are maybe loosely aligned with health and wellness, I would say, where the government has tried to lower the cost of that because it's, you know, health and wellness, and the government wants to endorse healthy living and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we were looking at providing a service for a sleep mask company, and we started to pitch them on duty drawback and all of that. And then when we did the homework for a while, we realized, oh, it's duty free. You know? So you don't even need duty drawback. We shouldn't have been pitching that to them in the first place. It's a different story now. Now, irrespective of the category, there's like these like flat tariffs, no matter what, if it's coming from this country, with some exceptions. But, you know, we're in a little bit of a different environment now, but tariffs have always existed. We've, at least where we're talking now, should we timestamp it, Rick? April 18th, you know, Friday, April 18th. 4 p.m. In East Coast time, you know, it looks like categories don't really matter that much anymore, except for one really critical one, which is anything that's under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement seems to be flying by with no additional tariffs, which is great, you know, and that actually is a huge amount of goods. I don't know how impactful that is for like direct to consumer brands, but it does impact, you know, tens and maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars of, you know, lumber or oil or what have you. That's protected based on this free trade agreement. But that's one category, you know, like into U.S. and what that means. And traditionally, it has been on a commodity basis, and you could kind of start seeing this in the Trump administration. They are starting to call out certain categories like pharmaceuticals, that's in the crosshairs recently, electronics, you know, rare earth, you know, that kind of thing. So let's see what happens there. Yeah. It just, nothing has really crystallized on that front. And then there's another thing, which luckily so far we've kind of not been impacted by, which is other countries putting reciprocal tariffs on our goods.
Right.
So there have been warnings and there have been threats, but largely it hasn't happened yet, except for one exception, which is obviously U.S.-made goods are being punished by Canada, and they implemented a flat 25% surtax on most U.S. Categories. Again, there are some categories that haven't been impacted. Again, mostly in like the health and wellness space. Because again, Canada is trying to keep costs low for health and wellness related matters that come from the US. But outside of that, if it's made in the US, it's right now, you know, as we speak, it's being hit with a 25% surtax.
Got it. And I don't know, it seems like for the past 5 years, we've been living in this bizarre land where supply chains have been disrupted, first by COVID. You know, we had this like long stretch of, you know, you might even say post-World War II with like loosening trade regulations in the past 20 years as the internet and global commerce has started to come up to speed. That has been a huge tailwind for international trade. COVID, I think, put the stops to a lot of things with containers, disruptions, Suez Canal, Canada manufacturing, stopping. Are the things that brands did to adjust to COVID during that time, are they working against what brands need to do now, or is it helpful? Like, did we learn some good skills during that time?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of both. I think that flexibility in supply chain became a really big buzzword phrase during the COVID period. And people were looking for alternatives of bringing things from China. If you recall, you know, patient zero was in China, you know, for COVID. And really, like, supply chains, they really froze, especially as they came from China. So there's been a tremendous amount of, where possible, diversification away from China, even in categories that have historically been, you know, 90% plus China. So apparel, that's been 90% plus China. You know, the problem is now it's only 70% China.
Right.
But the reality was just that China is just such a powerhouse,
right,
as it relates to certain categories, that the power of the economics of, like, how do I compete against somebody who's planning for the future? Something might happen with a Chinese, with a war, you know, a trade war, a hot war with China. I'm not going to source from China. Well, you look great in a situation like this, but you look like an idiot for 3 years.
Right.
And you're being killed on pricing. So how do you maintain your business, you know, being structurally, you know, 5-10% more expensive than your competitor in a super commoditized category, where, like, every 50 cents really, really matters. In Target is, you know, and that's how you sell, like, homeware, for example, is Target and Walmart, you know, and Target and Walmart are trying to drive down every single half penny, not even penny, but half penny, you know, they're trying to drive it down. And you're like, aha, but when crisis strikes, I'm...
you're going to come back to me. I'm going to look real smart.
Yeah, I'm going to look real smart.
That doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. So you kind of just have to go with what exists, and the market just consolidates around manufacturing virtually everything in certain categories, like toys, houseware, in apparel, you know, in China, and now you're stuck. So now there's really nothing you can do. So from that sense, you know, the market really has not adjusted to just the sheer dependency. Mm-hmm. On, like, I'll put it this way, you know, the rhetoric of our government, even under Biden, with China, you know, really
doing them. It really ratcheted up in the last 2 years.
It really ratcheted up. It ratcheted up to a level we hadn't seen under Trump one. It maintained, like, look, Biden kept the tariffs, those tariffs that everybody warned us about.
That's correct. Yes.
You know? And, like, okay, Biden's going to be president. He's surely going to lower all of them because they were so stupid and they hurt us so much. He kept all of them, you know?
Right.
So, you know, like, the rhetoric was kind of maintained. Maybe he cooled it off a little bit, maybe, you know, hard to say. And then it's like, and then it spiked again under Trump too, like, really spiked. So it was spiked under Trump one, kind of plateaued under Biden. He didn't really lower it. He kind of kept
right.
it.
Right.
And then really spiked under Trump. You know, business has not really kept up, you know, for that example, for that reason that I gave. It's like, what are you supposed to do if Walmart needs this price and you want to stay in business? What are you supposed to do? But it hasn't really kept up with the rhetoric of our government. And now we're in the situation where business and the economy just hasn't really, it's being whipsawed by political factors, you know, that we're just trying to adjust to now.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, look, and obviously these are the existential events, but I think going back to the core of Passport, compliance, localization, and fulfillment, essentially, cross-border logistics. What do brands underestimate most when they first decide to go international?
Yeah, I think that they think that whatever is working for them in the US is going to translate lock, stock, and barrel into their Canada, at the very least Canada. It's an English-speaking country, you know.
Right. Mostly.
I used to say, Rick, I used to call it just as a joke, you know, I used to say, it's like the 51st state, you know.
Right.
It has a different connotation now with Trump, you know, but it kind of is in a way. I mean, it's English speaking. There's so much cross pollination. We all have friends in Canada. They have friends here, you know, so it feels like everything should work. But frankly speaking, there's enough differences. Some of them are very nuanced. I'll tell you an interesting one, you know, diversity, you know, You know how like American brands, when they want to have their marketing and they want to communicate a diverse demand for their product, and they'll have in a photo, you know, a diverse set of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That looks different in Canada than it does in the U.S., you know?
Right.
They have a very big Sikh population in Canada. It might be somebody with a turban, right? You're not really going to see that in the U.S. when you think about diversity. You're not really going to think, you're not really going to do that. So they can tell in Canada when the imagery,
right,
and it's subtle. They might not even be able to articulate it, but they can see something is off. They're not really a Canadian business. They're not really targeting us. You know, you'll see Statue of Liberty versus, you know, the Canadian Tower, the Toronto Tower, or, you know, you won't see, like, you'll see Burger and Fries. We joked about this earlier. You won't see, you know what I mean? Some more traditional Canadian dishes. So it's different enough that they can tell that.
You're making me hungry for poutine, by the way.
Well, it's really good. I'm making myself.
Exactly. I mean, so it sounds like, if I'm hearing you right, it's really the localized cultural differences. It's almost like the unknown to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, do you expect getting products across border to be hard? Do you expect governments to be difficult, but not necessarily the sort of human relationship stuff and like the bias, you know, unconscious biases people have against foreign brands that don't translate to the market that you're trying to sell into.
Yeah, exactly. And it manifests itself in a lower conversion rate. That's how it happens.
So like if you were to put a number on it, I'm just going to use an example across all US e-commerce, you know, low conversion, but like 2-2.5% is like baseline conversion that someone will see. If you're not localized properly in the market, like where could your conversion rate drop to?
Oh, I mean, if you're like truly not localized, you're not doing anything localized, it'll be about half of what it could be if you were localized. So you could basically double your sales overnight by just, you know, changing some features.
Got it. I mean, that's a pretty major impact. This is not like a 10%. A little boost here.
It's really big. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, once you start knocking out like the low hanging fruit, like the, you know, like the diversity in pictures, I'm not sure how much that's going to equal in conversion rate. It's more of like the vibe. So like that one thing might be like worth, you know, 0.5% or something like that, you know, in incremental conversion rate juice. But like the whole vibe of like this starting to feel like a company that gets me as a person and my country, my people and all of that, that's worth a lot.
Yeah. I mean, look, you mentioned at the end of the day, a big part of your solution, not exclusively, is you have a shipping rate card. I mean, if you talk to any head of logistics, I don't care if yourself, it's almost like it's not really a dirty secret, but it's like something that everyone hates, that you talk to a chief logistics officer, the first thing they want to ask you is costs.
Yeah.
You know, like, what's your price? How can I get a better price? What's my dim? You know, where am I on the grid? How can I get lower? And look, part of the reason is obviously logistics is a huge percentage of cost to do business, but also for the consumer, if you were to just sort of get rack UPS international rates that sort of came with your domestic contract, because that's most of your thing. And then now all of a sudden you're shipping using that rate card into the UK or Canada or, God forbid, Australia or Hong Kong, where there's a lot of like US expats and English speakers that would happily buy from US brands. You wouldn't even have to solve the localization issue. Like, how much difference in the, like we talked about the conversion rate issue from the, I almost think there are two problems with high shipping rates. One is, goes back to conversion rate, one. And then two is the cost too damn high, really? You know, and it's like, it's too expensive for the buyer to pay. It's too expensive for the merchant to pay. How do you think through that?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. You know, shipping and international shipping it can be a higher percentage of the order value than the cost of goods sold itself.
Yeah.
You know? So if you're a brand decision maker and you're like, where do I spend some incremental time? Is it to drive down the cost of my goods, or is it to, you know, drive down the cost of my shipping? You know, you really got to do that math, because sometimes shipping and fulfillment, you know, and I'll throw that in there as well, but just the ops stack is more than the cost of the good itself, right? And e-commerce in general, it's like things under $150. You know, so we're not, there's not that many things that are like,
we're not talking about luxury items. Or
That's, I mean, there are, of course, there's like Tiffany's, there's like a bunch of big brands like that, but most of e-commerce, I think I saw a stat one time that like 90% of e-commerce is under 150. And, you know, I believe it, it makes sense just in our own personal lives, what we're looking to buy online. So, you know, I think about it two ways. So one is, there's two service levels that you can have for international. Essentially, there's obviously more, but like, let's just break it down. There's the fast service level, like express or expedited, which is super expensive. Like we're talking $30, $40 a shipment, okay? And then there's priority service level, which is slower. It's sometimes called the deferment model or a consolidator model, where the transit time is somewhere between, call it 4 business days to 9 business days, versus express could be 2 to 3 business days, right? So it's slower. Sometimes in the, you know, the far reaches of Australia, it could take, you know, 10 business days. So which 2 weeks to get there, right? But it's much cheaper. I mean, like order of magnitude cheaper. We're talking about like closer to like $10 a pound versus $30 a pound. So really like game changing solution, right? So the problem is sometimes, especially when it comes to cross-border shoppers and direct-to-consumer, is that these are things that people like to give as gifts, you know, either for themselves or for others, or they're buying it for an event. So what we usually recommend brands is give people the option, and think of shipping, in particular express shipping, as a product in and of itself. It's a service and it's a product. And offer it in your cart alongside the cheaper option. So offer the cheaper option for free. Offer, you know, bake in, you know, get your highest conversion rate possible. Offer shipping for free, or for something really like rounding down, like it looks really low, like $5. Right. And then offer an option that's a 2 to 3 day option for someone that needs this as a gift or for an event or what have you. Charge them for it. Charge them $20 for it. Charge them $25 for it. You know, and that's been the most, you know, like, again, we're here to help brands with conversion rate optimization. That really solves for conversion rate optimization. The other outlet is something we talked about earlier, which is ship from China to Australia and fulfill locally, you know?
Right.
And that's one of our solutions, is we help brands set up local operations in the country. They don't need to register for a corporate tax or get a VAT number or any. They don't need any of that headache. They can use us, and they could use our registrations, and we could help them get going very easily, very quickly, and manage operations locally there. So now you're talking about a domestic Australian shipment, which is much cheaper. Then you could really compare the costs of shipping domestically in Australia and Canada. It's comparable to the cost to ship domestically here in the US. So if your economics work in the US, they should work in Australia and Canada as well.
Right. No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And making something a local transaction, I mean, that makes your payment processor cost less. It makes your shipping, if you're just having to, the parcel has to go shorter time, which means fewer trucks, fewer planes, less things can go wrong, all those things.
Precisely.
So what's preventing the average brand of just saying, like, look, Passport gets these low rates. Like, why can't I get the same low rates on my own? Why do I need a solution to get these kind of rates?
Yeah. Well, they could get those low rates from us, you know? We're happy to engage with big brands who present a ton of volume, and not only will they get rates, but they deserve it. You know, they're bringing a lot of volume and a lot of scale to our network, you know, and our unit economics go down, you know, when we work with a large brand. We're sending a truck to their 3PL, you know, and you could either load it with, you know, 100 items and we're paying $1,000 for that truck, or you could load it with 1,000 items. So if you're loading it 1,000 items, we can pass that cost savings to the brand. You know, if a brand is thinking, I'm going to get lower rates with, you know, our competitors and things like that, of course, that's, you know, that's their job to go and try to negotiate for the lowest possible rate. But if they're saying, if you're saying, Rick, that a brand is going to go and negotiate with like Canada Post.
Yeah. Yeah. With the carriers. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. With the carriers and go negotiate like a trucking, like, no. I mean, Canada Post, frankly speaking, they don't really engage with brands in general. They engage with like wholesalers like us. You know, maybe they'll engage with like Amazon, of course, but they're not really working with 3PLs or brands. It's just that's not their business model. So first of all, it's going to be really hard to even get their engagement.
Right.
And if they do, they're going to require so much volume that, you know, it's going to be tough. And let's say for argument's sake, you are able to get those low rates from Canada Post. How are you going to get them those packages? Well, now you got to do a sort. Now you got to sort it by.
You need to obey their rules, which you don't know anything about.
Exactly. And you got to clear customs in Canada, and you got to send a truck to Canada that knows what they're doing to cross over. And that's just Canada, you know, not to mention every other country. So it never really makes sense to go direct to Canada or Australia or whatever. It always makes sense to work with a company like ours, like a consolidator for a million different reasons. But, you know, just the complexity of it, that's the biggest one, I'd say.
No, that makes sense. I mean, so these brands obviously are helped working with a partner. If we're talking about kind of this tariff regime, now tariffs are going to be around for a while. Like we're becoming, you know, a little bit more protectionist as a rule, probably across administrations, even if we project in the future. Of course, humans always project everything that's happening right now indefinitely into the future. That's one of our weaknesses, I think. What does that mean for a brand playbook in terms of its changes? It's just more of what you said before, kind of like diversifying where you're shipping from, moving parcels, you know, landing in your target markets, that kind of thing?
I would go down this order of operations. I would say, can I move my production to the U.S.? Yes or no? Absolutely not. There's just no way of doing it, at least over the next 2 years. You know, maybe it's a decade long project. You know, let's just assume that that's not practical.
Yeah.
Okay. Then my next question is, okay, I can't do that. My next question is, can I manufacture in a more friendly environment? So what is a more friendly environment? Anything other than China right now. Then it's like,
sounds like there's sort of tiers, like tier one.
Unfriendly
is China.
Yeah.
Tier two unfriendly is what?
Like Vietnam, Cambodia, Asian countries, I would say. And then tier three, if we're going into the direction of most friendliest, the higher the tier, the more friendliest. I would say Canada and Mexico.
Right.
They weren't mentioned on Trump's Liberation Day. It's still, you know, like the U.S.-Mexico-Canada free trade agreement has not been torn up. It's still more or less active.
Which, by the way, Trump negotiated.
Yeah. Right. So I would say Canada and Mexico are, you know, your next best bets. So depending on where you end up, and if you ultimately end up in a situation where you are going to have to face tariffs, then, I mean, irrespective of even that, you still want to diversify away from the U.S. Just nice to have a situation where if the U.S., you know, goes through a recession, at least you have other markets that might not have gone. Usually when the U.S. goes into recession, you know, most other countries do too, but sometimes not.
Right.
And sometimes others are in different depths of that recession. And just nice to have diversification on your revenue base. But it's even more important when you're talking about a high tariff regime like the U.S. You know, that really makes it tough for you to sell. It's nice to have other markets.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I mean, thinking about this from the point of view of a logistics officer, you were asleep for the last year and a half. You woke up yesterday. What are the first three questions you want to ask yourself?
Yeah. Where am I sourcing? Why am I sourcing from this location? Can I source somewhere else? You know, tariffs is a, we've been talking about this, but tariffs is a new consideration. The magnitude of tariffs is a new consideration. It's a new normal, right? Mm-hmm. Next question is, what are my markets? You know, how do I avoid the US tariff regime? How do I set my business up for success in other markets and be able to provide a localized experience on a logistics front, if we're talking about it, mm-hmm. a chief logistics officer? You know, how do I try to minimize the transit time for my goods in country, minimize my all-in lane of cost and my minimize my fulfillment expenses as well, you know? And three, what are the the intangibles that I should be aware of? Like, for example, returns, you know, that's not so much an intangible, but it's just like another category of problems that you have to work with. But for some categories, it's such an important consideration, you know, of like apparel or shoes or things like that. Those categories are built around returns, and there's nothing wrong with returns. It's just part of the part of the equation. You need to make sure that you've solved for that. Otherwise, you're going to be in a position of solving everything, but you have a horrible return policy, or it kills you financially, and everything kind of falls apart from there, you know. And you know, other things like that, like how important is transit time? You know, really testing some of those assumptions, I would say is a third one.
Got it. And I mean, I couldn't help but notice in the last 6 months you guys have acquired Brand Access, and so. In particular, like helping brands, you know, I've been in the cross-border industry in the past. It's like once you kind of max out your cross-border opportunity, it's a heck of a lot more efficient for your more mature markets to have the goods close to the consumer, as you said before. And so is that the idea behind that acquisition?
100%, 100%. We saw this with our existing accounts that were doing cross-border. They were inquiring with us on how they can set up local operations. We saw this with accounts that we don't work with, you know, that are in the enterprise space. They weren't looking at, the other players in the market. They were looking at how do I really make international a really big success. And part of that is providing for local consumers in those markets a super hyper localized experience. And part of that is domestic shipping. So the only way to do that is to do local fulfillment. So we bought a company that basically is the easy button for large brands to set up local ops. We do it today for Canada, UK, EU, Australia, New Zealand, and in Mexico, we recently launched as well.
Got it. No, I mean, I think it's exciting because the cross-border industry has historically not had an answer for this kind of situation where it's almost viewed as kind of like training wheels for global commerce. And you're like, I better bring it in-house because the costs are too high or because this is not going to scale forever. And so it sounds like you're giving those brands a solution to scale kind of to the next tier of customer experience, which means like reducing friction for the buyer, reducing costs for both sides, like all those things.
Totally.
That makes sense. As you, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think wrapping up, I would love to look out the next couple of years in the future for Passport, either generally at the market for global trade or specifically with Passport with like other major friction points that you see on the horizon that your customers are starting to ask you about. They're like, yeah, this is on the horizon for Passport too. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah. So a few things are on our horizon. One is we go after US-based brands, Canadian-based brands, but we're expanding to UK. We hired a great person there, and we're going to be helping UK-based brands ship into the US. And frankly speaking, we've been helping Canadian brands ship rest of world and kind of have ignored shipping into the US because it was, you know, under de minimis, tried and true methods. We didn't feel like there were that many areas of differentiation, but that's all different now. The de minimis has gone away. right. at least for Chinese made goods, which is most. And there's so much confusion about how to ship parcel into the US. And this is such a strength of ours, Rick. You know, we're really great at the compliance. We're really great at the physical logistics. And we're going to hit the market very hard of shipping from UK to rest of the world, of course, but to US in particular and Canada as well. And beyond that, we're going to go into EU and Australia and so forth. So that's all upcoming for us. And then I would say the other frontier that we're helping out, but I would say is something that we're going to invest more in, is marketing, top of funnel marketing. Mm-hmm. We want to help our brands find success on the marketing side of things. You know, right now we do something casual. We refer them to certain agencies who we know mm-hmm. or give them the tips and tricks. We're more a little bit downstream of top of funnel, and we help with the conversion rate, but we want to be able to help with the top of funnel as well and add value there.
Yeah, I mean, again, kind of having been in the cross-border space, there's just like trifecta of, you know, known brand, stuff people want, no customs restrictions, is light enough that you could ship it over without a huge degree of challenge. But if your brand isn't known, then that's a big challenge to cross border, because the juice may not be worth the squeeze in some of those things. And so local marketing could help people launch in a specific market and kind of go there. So I appreciate that.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation, Alex. I'm looking forward to seeing what Passport does in the future.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me. That was great.
All right. Thanks so much. That's all for this week. Till next time, Watsonians. Hi, I'm Rick Watson, CEO and founder of RMW Commerce Consulting and host of the Watson Weekly Podcast, your essential e-commerce digest. Our production partner for the series is Podcasts on the Fly. To hear new episodes of the show every Monday morning, subscribe now at rmwcommerce.com/WatsonWeekly and wherever you get your podcasts.